KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have on the show someone who I've wanted to have on the show for a few years, Peter Asaro. Peter is a professor and also, for our purposes, as he was identified in the media, a killer robot expert. But really what we're talking about is Peter is one of the nation's leading experts thinking through the development of robotics and really the introduction of robotics at a wide-scale level in society. Peter and I actually have similar affiliations in that he is also an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford and also a visiting fellow this spring at Princeton. And so although I knew Peter's work, and I think we may have even traded an email or two in the past, I had more of an opportunity this year at Princeton to chat with Peter, and so I'm delighted to have him on the show. Peter's a prolific writer in this space, and so there's a lot we could talk about. However, we're going to focus on a draft article that he has available on the WeRobot.org website, WeRobot being a annual conference around robotics scholarship that was founded a few years ago by Ryan Kahlo. The article, which you can find at the WeRobot website, is entitled Regulating Robots, Approaches to Developing Robot Policy and Technology. Peter is in a space which is slowly growing. As someone who entered the technology law space, really at this point, it's kind of crazy for me to think about it, but really about 15 years ago, but really entered the academic side of it about 8 years ago, it seems like robotics is in that kind of very early nascent internet law stage. In other words, it is a new field, a newer field than internet law, and one which is slowly developing, very slowly, because we don't have robots operating at the level that Peter and others predict will happen in the coming years. But we're starting to think through law on these questions. And so recently we've had Ryan Kahlo and Woody Hartzog on the show to talk about robotics, and Peter comes at these issues with a little bit different perspective, but no less expertise. Peter's focused heavily on weaponized robotics, things like unmanned aerial vehicles, or known as drones, and robots that are armed, and we're going to talk about that work. Additionally, we're going to spend time focusing on the regulatory questions that he is considering and writing about, and really just define some terms like robot itself, which I think even though we have a general understanding of what we think a robot is, that name itself is being redefined by scholars thinking through these issues. Peter is a philosopher of science, technology, and media, and he focuses also on artificial intelligence issues, which we'll talk about a bit. He has held research positions at the Center for Cultural Analysis at Rutgers, at the HUMI Lab in Sweden, and at the Austrian Academy of Sciences in Vienna. He's worked not only in a scholarly capacity, but in the field, developing technologies in the area of virtual reality. He is currently working on this oral history of robotics, that we'll talk about a bit. And he got his PhD in history, philosophy, and sociology from the University of Illinois, where he also got a master's and a master of computer science from the Department of Computer Science there. He is an assistant professor at the School of Media Studies at the New School. So like me, with these other affiliations, I point out that my day job and full-time job is at Elon. So too, Peter is at the New School. He is joining us on May 13th, 2015, via Skype from his home in Brooklyn. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Peter, let me ask you this question I ask most of my guests. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to focus on robotics.
My background was really philosophy and computer science. I really studied both as an undergraduate, and I was really, really interested in the questions around artificial intelligence and can machines think, our brains, computers, is our mind a computer? how are all these things related? So a lot of cognitive science issues, a lot of artificial intelligence issues. And in graduate school, I continued to pursue that, both in philosophy through the PhD in the history, philosophy, sociology of science, really looking at early cybernetics and artificial intelligence and cognitive science in the 1930s to 1960s period. But at the same time, I was working on a PhD that I computer science that I never quite finished, where I was really working in contemporary machine learning, neural networks, artificial intelligence, trying to think about how all of these things kind of fit together. But I was very much in the, I'd say, the AI realm. But through my interest really in early cybernetics and looking at electronic models of the brain, which were a lot of analog computers in the 1940s and 50s especially, got really interested in the hardware level and the machines and embodiment and what it really meant to have a mind that could interact with the world and not just systems of symbols or representations. So I got really interested in robotics because of that, and I did a documentary film in 2000, 2001 called Love Machine, which sort of, instead of asking the question about artificial intelligence and thinking that, say, intelligence or playing chess or doing math is the epitome of what it is to be human, and then can we get a machine to do that, to instead say, well, actually, being human involves having a body, having emotions, can we build a machine that does that? So looking at people like Rodney Brooks and the AI lab at MIT at the time, that were starting to really look at human-robot interaction and can you build, you know, emotional models and recognition systems and things like that into the robots. So I interviewed people like that and Herbert Dreyfuss, who's more of a critic of the AI, but also a fan of the more Heideggerian embodiment stuff. So I got to meet a lot of roboticists and I learned a lot more about robotics. And after that, I actually worked in a robotics company for a few years doing computer vision and neural networks for some walking control systems and things like that. And also did some natural language processing for Wolfram Alpha. So I've always tried to combine the kind of theoretical approach with the technology and the engineering side of things. So that's kind of how I got to robotics. And then at some point after that documentary, somebody asked me to write a piece to contribute to a special issue on robot ethics. And I'd never really thought about robot ethics or what that would be. And I really hadn't done much ethics as a graduate student in philosophy. But I thought it was an interesting question, so I wrote a paper about it and basically concluded that the most interesting question is whether we're going to allow robots to kill people or not, and why or why not we might do that. And that sort of set me on this trajectory of thinking through some things in just war theory and how that would apply to robotics, and then eventually thinking about what we might be able to do on a more legal side in terms of arms control internationally around robots, or how we are to develop policies for, say, safety of small drones or self-driving cars and the liability issues. So I'm not really a lawyer by training, but I found the legal structures very, very interesting in terms of how they manage liability and accountability in these very complex socio-technical systems, and often have, you know, very pragmatic aims ultimately, where the philosophers, you know, can split hairs about ethics and responsibility and the applicability to, say, policymaking can be much more obscure many times.
So, Peter, of course, I recognize you're in the wonderful borough of Brooklyn, so no worries about the activity around you. Let me ask you this. I didn't mention it in the introduction. You are the spokesperson for an entity called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. Tell us a little bit about that and what the campaign is designed to do.
Yeah, so the campaign is a coalition of non-governmental organizations that joined together 2 years ago to work towards an international prohibition on fully autonomous weapon systems. And then my own NGO, which I started in 2009 with some others, is called the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. And so that was about 3 years before the campaign. And really what we were trying to do is just get some discussion going on, because it was pretty clear from the Pentagon's kind of roadmaps for UAV development and future forces that they want to have, a whole array of robotic weapon systems, increasing levels of autonomy in those systems, and things like swarms and robotic systems that will basically be able to attack targets independently of human control at some level. And we find this very concerning for, an array of different reasons. But how do you actually, get people talking about that and aware of it and then get some kind of action at an international level? So we joined forces with Human Rights Watch and the Nobel Women's Initiative and many of the campaigners from the campaign to ban landmines and the cluster munitions coalition to ban cluster munitions. So they have experience on how to operate at the international level. So we've been campaigning both at the Human Rights Council, but primarily at the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which is a treaty organization under the United Nations that has as a prerogative to regulate conventional weapons, and they've done some bans on certain forms of landmines and cluster munitions, but more recently the permanently blinding lasers were preemptively banned in that forum. So we've gotten some traction there, and they've had some expert meetings last spring and this spring, which just took place a couple weeks ago, so I was there for both of those meetings. And we heard from an array of different legal and technical and military experts on the issue, and we're really trying to move them forward at this point to something that could actually lead to a more formal process that could lead to a treaty negotiation, hopefully in the next few years. So we're waiting to see what they do at their next meeting in November as far as advancing that agenda.
Is the campaign to stop killer robots kind of in the model of groups like the Federation of American Scientists that were born out of the Manhattan Project and designed to not just deal with the ethics of, in that case, atomic and nuclear weaponry, but at some level to stop the use of those technologies? Now, the campaign is called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. And so do you see that group and your group as an extension of that philosophy around weaponry and technology and, as you alluded to earlier, the ethics of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of strong similarities and overlap, if you will. I think as organizations, they function somewhat differently. I think our International Committee for Robot Arms Control was very much conceived as a group of experts in the various areas of robotics and artificial intelligence, philosophy and ethics, law and policy, political science, international affairs, that are concerned with the issue and being able to deploy our expertise to try to sway policymakers. And actually one of the other groups in the coalition, the leadership of the campaign, which, so there's 9 NGOs in the leadership committee, and then there's, I think there's about 50 or so now NGOs internationally in about 24 different countries that are part of the campaign. But Pugwash International is one of those organizations on the steering committee, and they're, were famously started by Einstein and many of the other physicists who in various ways had, some of whom have really participated in the development of nuclear technology and the theory underlying it, and were really quite, shocked and concerned about the development of nuclear weapons and, that the science would be applied that way, and trying to use their voices as scientists and experts to really kind of reel it back in. And I think the stop, emphasis, although negative, and usually want a campaign to be positive, but I think we're really like looking at this as a preemptive arms control that, these systems are under development, but right now there aren't any governments that are really dependent on these systems strategically or politically or economically. So it's much easier to, to give it up now than once we allow the development of all these systems. And if we find out how, bad they can be, then we're going to be much more difficult to get countries to give them up, much like nuclear weapons. And just to, clarify a little bit, so what we're calling killer robots the United Nations has been calling lethal autonomous weapons systems, or, you know, my preferred term is just autonomous weapons system, is really any system that's capable of targeting, which means selecting targets on its own, and then firing and using violent force against those targets independently of any human supervision. So those are the kind of two crucial steps to get an autonomous weapon or a killer robot. There's a lot of remotely operated systems, and, you know, we've seen a lot of the Predator and Reaper drone strikes and targeted killings and things like that. But in those cases, there's still a human who's making the targeting decisions and firing the weapons. They're just not in the aircraft. They're remotely located. But the next generation of systems that are in development already will be able to use, you know, algorithms that select targets based on some, you know, criteria, a formula of sensor data, and use that as a basis for killing people. And so that's really a robot that is, you know, delegated the authority to kill. And that's, you know, something we think is a line that, if you cross, has pretty profound ramifications for our concepts of human rights and human dignity and the value of human life.
We're chatting with Peter Asaro, professor at the School of Media Studies at the New School on KZSU-FM Stanford. You know, Peter, there's so much in this space, as I mentioned in the introduction, that we don't even at this point have the ability to point to examples of, right? And what I mean is, right, we're still talking about, in large measure, military uses or uses that, you know, involve defense, if you will. But, of course, we've had robots, you know, is going back decades, and whether it's the assembly line or a home uses of things like Roombas, we see a slow development of these devices in ways that we haven't thought through. As I mentioned in my introduction, there are a limited number of people looking at these issues, and it really is quite something. What do you make of that analogy that I drew to the internet law field of, say, 15 years ago? And perhaps you could talk a little bit about the We Robot Conference, but really more directly, who is it outside of defense contractors and others that are using this technology who are thinking about these legal, ethical, social, moral questions about their use?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's still a fairly small group, and I think it's, you know, the We Robot crowd captures a lot of that group pretty well. It's maybe more heavy on the lawyers than some of the other groups. The other places where I've participated in these kinds of discussions, there's a sort of also a robot ethics community that pops up in different kind of conference situations. There's an international computing and philosophy conference that's been going on for a number of years, and they'll usually have a track on the robotics stuff. Then there's, you know, and this is the sort of academic discourse, I would say, primarily. But there's, I think, a growing number of lawyers who are actually starting to participate in some of these discussions. The other place where I think in robotics it's been discussed a bit as well, especially within human-robot interaction, there's a notion that, you know, you have to understand human social relations and norms of behavior in order to successfully interact with humans as a robot. So you have to read human behavior, but you also have to exhibit human-like behavior. So there's been an interest and a concern around how do you do that, you know, create essentially polite robots. And there's also been some robot ethics discussions within the IEEE's Robotics and Automation Society and their annual meetings. So there's been discussions, but I think there's the sort of ethics people that kind of initiated the discussion, and now the lawyers are really kind of moving into it more strongly. And, you know, there's so many different applications of robots, and the law is so multifaceted in how it would apply to these different robots. That's, as I try to get my head around it, like, what does it mean to regulate robots? It's actually all these different areas of law that come into play. And I think certainly something similar happened with computers back in the day, but it also seems that, you know, through things like intellectual property and end-user license agreements, they came rather quickly to a framework where they could kind of constrain the enormous complexity of ways in which computers would interact with the world into some very clear kind of legal frameworks for dealing with it. But if you think, you know, military robotic systems are going to fall under international laws of arms control and things like that, you have self-driving cars, which are going to fall under product liability, but also all of the, you know, highways, traffic safety kinds of authorities. You have these little toy drones that you can buy for $200 that, you know, the FAA is suddenly claiming all kinds of jurisdiction on that they sort of carefully said they didn't really have, you know, they did have jurisdiction over model aircraft before, but they just kind of issued some, you know, guidelines and say, you know, be careful with these, don't fly in their airports or too high or to make them too heavy. But now they're really trying to kind of reel that back in and heavily regulate the kinds of uses of small drones. So the, you know, that's in itself, especially the FAA thing, because there's so many people flying these drones, we've already seen, I think, law firms, you know, start specializing and offering services to their clients in terms of the drone stuff. I think, you know, if the self-driving cars really move as quickly as some hope, if, you know, Tesla is saying they're going to have some self-driving functionality in their cars by this year, or the end of this year, then I think, you know, their lawyers are going to start catching up on those issues, and, you know, the other car companies are going to be doing something similar. So I think we'll see it there. We've already seen it, I think, a bit with the medical robotics, which are mostly these teleoperated surgical systems like Da Vinci. That's one of the funnier websites to go visit is badrobotsurgery.com, where it's basically lawyers
that
are trying to get class action suits against poorly performed robotic surgeries.
So they're seeking clients through this website?
The what?
They're seeking clients through this website?
Yeah. It's you know, it's the kind of ad you might see in a subway for personal injury lawyers or something like that. But in this case, specialized in the robotics area.
Hmm.
And I think those are really the three applications of robotics that are the furthest along. Apart from, I guess, maybe the toys and the vacuum cleaners. The vacuum cleaners have gotten pretty far as well. But the next round, right, and the drones have really moved very, very quickly. And I think the urgency around robot ethics right now and robot law is seeing that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, these things were just toys that a handful of people were playing with. And now they're pretty much widespread. And You go to any public park in New York, and you're likely to see one buzzing around. If you go to any major, you know, parade or event, you'll see them flying overhead, taking video. And people, I think, are very concerned about it, right? So you see them flying, you feel like you're being watched. You don't know necessarily who's flying it or what they're doing or whether they're taking pictures or not. But it, you know, Ryan Callow, again, sort of calls this the catalyst effect to catalyzes our sense of being surveyed. And I think in that way, robots, unlike the computers, which, you know, it's a box and it's sort of dark, and all the information inside of it is pretty opaque. You don't really know as you travel through the internet that it's collecting all kinds of information about you. But when you see a camera, you know, hovering and flying and filming you, you feel much more viscerally that you're being surveilled, and you react, I think, much more viscerally. So hopefully that'll also motivate people to try to assert privacy rights and think through, maybe in a larger public discussion, like, what do we want privacy in public to be like? What rights do people have? And should we try to protect against the advancing technological sophistication? And as I look at it, there's, you know, drones really just offer a different vantage point for putting up a camera. But there's already, you know, fixed cameras that can record you all over the place. And we're also developing all kinds of, you know, remote sensing kinds of technologies like x-rays and microwaves and things that are, you know, scanning you at the airport right now. But these will all soon be handheld cameras or things that you can even put into a cell phone. And, you know, what's the world going to be when everybody's cell phone basically has X-ray vision? Are you going to be allowed to scan whoever you want? Is that going to be a controlled technology? So there's a lot of things to think through in this domain.
You know, Peter, and we're chatting with Peter Asaro on KZSO FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, as long as we're running through these current uses, you know, one of the areas which is starting to get more attention is one which, quite frankly, I thought would get attention almost immediately and didn't seem to be, which is just the basic concern that robots are going to take jobs that human beings are currently doing. Now, of course, we've seen with every advancement of technology that that has been the case. So the internet has taken jobs from people who otherwise would have been doing that work. Is robotics in that sense any different than the internet and other technologies that have been able to replicate human activity? You know, it would seem to me that the largest risk of robotics would be in less skilled type positions, and so I've read articles about robots, you know, basically becoming servers in restaurants. But how real is that risk in terms of the labor market effects of robotics, in your view?
I think it's a big issue, and it's certainly been around for a while. And that, you know, I actually collected all the as many as I could find of these books from the 60s about all of the fears of robots taking over jobs and putting everybody out of work. And you know, too, they did displace a lot of workers in the 70s and 80s. And you know, I think historically, like looking back at it, a lot of outsourcing was also occurring at the same time, which also led to a lot of job loss. And it's kind of hard, I think, to separate those two out. If you're looking at, you know, industrial manufacturing jobs in the United States, and like, where did they all go in the 70s and 80s? So that's part of it. But there was also, as you say, the computerization, which was really the automation of all sorts of office work. And part of it is that these things were super efficient, and they were able to actually replace people, in a sense. You know, you look at what you have to do now in your typical kind of business job. You know, you have to put together your own PowerPoints. You have to make your own travel arrangements. You have to type all of your own memos, right? So the typical office worker, you know, in the Mad Men era, there was a travel agent that booked your tickets, and there was a typist who typed your notes, and there was, you know, a graphic designer who would put together your presentation. So you had a lot more people working on the team to do, you know, what it is you as a team needed to do. And now that team is, you know, one person with really sophisticated software. But you still sort of need the humidity. These certain junctures, and you know, management, and at the kind of upper level, and the more sort of white collar versus blue collar jobs, or skilled jobs versus the unskilled jobs. But I think we're seeing a shift with that, both with the artificial intelligence and the robotics, which is able to now sort of target some of the really more sophisticated skilled jobs that are more high paid as well. So I think part of the current anxiety is that a lot of really, you know, highly skilled jobs are going to be eliminated through this kind of automation. not just, you know, the repetitive assembly line job, but the highly skilled machinists and craftspeople are being, you know, potentially replaced. In the law field, you know, there used to be all sorts of legal aids to do discovery and things like that, and there's now pretty good software that's, you know, can replace large numbers of legal aids. When is it going to start replacing, you know, junior lawyers and law firms and things like that? I think there was a lot of hope around large-scale education all over the internet that hasn't quite played out as hoped. It doesn't quite have the economy of scale as, you know, manufacturing has. Education, I think, is one of those things that's a little bit different. I think we may find with healthcare that it's also something that's certain aspects of it, you know, there's an economy of scale to automating it en masse, but a lot of what happens in healthcare is the care part of it, which is a human-to-human relation of trying to understand what's wrong and trying to resolve the problems, that just being able to automate certain treatments or diagnoses or tests isn't really going to be sufficient to actually do the entire job of healthcare. Or with education, just being able to automate test grading doesn't mean you've replicated education. So I think there's some hope that humans are still going to be necessary, but I think there's definitely going to be large-scale job shifts, employment shifts, that are going to be really painful to a lot of people. And if we really see the self-driving car move into a usable, practical technology, you're talking about laying off most taxi drivers and truck drivers and any kind of professional driver. And that's actually the number one job in most states in the United States is truck driver. And if you look in, say, New York City where I am, one of the top jobs for recent immigrants that pays well enough to support a family is taxi driver. And you're really eliminating those jobs. I think, you've affected a specific demographic in a very particular way, and ones that are not easily, it's not going to be easy to retrain them and give them different skill sets. So education kind of needs to keep up. And I think that's kind of the theme of the paper I have about the regulating robots that you mentioned at the mm-hmm. top, which is we spend a lot of time and effort, and we've gotten really, really good at technological innovation in our society. But we don't spend as much time or energy on thinking through the norms and values that we want, the society to realize through these technologies, and thus, the policies and laws that we really want to apply to them. So we kind of wind up in these situations where we have this, onslaught of new technologies, and the policymakers are constantly trying to figure out, how to deal with it. But at the same time, we haven't, as a society and a culture, really talked through and thought through what we want from these new technological innovations. And there's, in my view, it's emergent and it's very open-ended. We can actually design technologies in a lot of different ways, depending on our interest as a society and our needs as a society. But we have to do the work of thinking about how we want those to go. And if we don't do that, we just kind of wind up with whatever the developers think we want, or whatever is going to, make them the most money in the current scheme of things. So I think we need to spend more time and more effort kind of innovating around norms and thinking about what we actually want technology to be doing, and then develop policies that help us get there.
We're chatting with Peter Asaro, the spokesperson for the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, also an assistant professor at the School of Media Studies at the New School, and a fellow at the Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Peter, you paint a pretty scary picture of the impact of robots on the labor market. It sounds like we're talking about having well into double digits unemployment with people that are unable to earn money. And yet you talk about design and deciding what those ethics look like and what the rules might be around developing these technologies as a way to deal with it. Let's start with that horror scenario. Are you suggesting that we run the risk of a society of having the kinds of unemployment that would create protests and worse in society, as you have people who simply cannot find jobs? Or Or will the technologies themselves, as some have said, create new opportunities for those same people to do jobs that we cannot at this time identify? What's your take as you gaze into that crystal ball that recognize that it is making a prediction? So I'm not really as much asking for a prediction as I am getting your sense of what we think we know about where this is headed.
Yeah, so I think this question about the economics of unemployment and the introduction of robotics and automation, that if our economic theories are correct, and I think they're pretty solid most of the time, in the long run, there should be, these mechanisms that will rebalance the system, and people will get displaced from jobs, but eventually they'll find other jobs. In the same way that, in the 19th century, a lot of people lost their jobs in, textile mills, but eventually, got jobs in other fields, right? But it's often in that case, it was often a generation or two to recover. And we're talking about a society where technology is changing so rapidly that, within a generation, you're seeing multiple technological revolutions. So in my generation, that we've already had the kind of internet revolution. If we have another robotics revolution before the end of it, then that's two major technological revolutions. And what's the possibility of being able to retrain and re-educate people for that workforce, given all the realities of actually how difficult it is to already get along in society and demands of family and the education system that we have and things like that. So I think there's really a couple of other significant underlying problems that make it maybe more scary, but may also lead us to make a better long-term policy choice that could be much better, which is, I think, the inequality issues in economics right now are, quite scary in and of themselves without the kind of introducing the automating technologies and that we have. And so, David Graeber's book about debt and Piketty's book about inequality, really kind of points to the fact that structurally the economy has some issues with regard to the distribution of wealth. But if we allow the automation to, take away what jobs are left for the middle class and the lower class and even a lot of the professional class, that could radically destabilize society, potentially, especially if it happens much more quickly than new jobs are introduced. And part of the arguments that these MIT economists, whose name is very difficult to pronounce, Jorns Zorf, I believe, is that, after 2009, corporations laid off a lot of workers, replaced them with a lot of technology, and actually productivity is higher than ever, but they actually haven't rehired the same number of workers. And so this is what's contributing to some of these numbers that show, much higher returns going to capital than to labor in the kind of classic economic model. So if those trends continue, maybe that's just a blip and it restabilizes, but maybe it doesn't, and maybe that becomes an increasing gap where you find that the people who already own things continue to own more and more things because they don't have to hire workers anymore. They have robots. And there's still a few workers, but they slowly get kind of pushed out of the economy. Now, classical economic theory is going to say eventually we'll figure out other things to do. We start making art and, doing things like that instead. And it should also say that, well, all these goods that are being manufactured are going to be ridiculously cheap because, prices are being driven down by automation. But also people will have less and less money to spend on things, so demand is going to go down. But it seems to me it's going to be a very unstable economic period before we reach some, stable thing. And that's, I think, where a lot of the interest now and discussion is starting to look at things like guaranteed income, which is probably a better mode of society anyway, and could possibly address some of the inequality issues as well. But just saying that every individual has a guaranteed income, and from taking that as a starting point, and then if you want to be, you know, a professional or an artist, or, you know, try to increase your income above that, there would be ways to do that. But you wouldn't be completely dependent on a job for all of your income and your health care and a lot of the way, things that are sort of built into the U.S. economy at this time.
So, Peter, we're at the point in the interview already, which I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking you questions that you don't have time to answer adequately in the time we have left, and then I ask the questions anyway. In your paper, you refer to four possibilities for norms to deal with disruptive technologies, right? And disruptive technologies is another phrase that has reached a high level of currency in discussion of business models. Again, I think born out of disruptive technologies in the internet space. But what are those norms, and how are they a good way, in your view, to think about these hyper-complex questions in their early stages?
Yeah, so the notion of the disruptive technology is, and sort of as a philosopher of technology, I should say that a lot of times we fixate on the object or the material embodiment or the artifact or the instrument of a technology, where my view of a technology is that it also includes the practices and the kind of socio-technical system as a whole in which that technology is embedded. So the technology doesn't just sort of stand apart from the society, it's embedded. And when you introduce a new technology, you're essentially reconfiguring that social political structure, the sets of practices that people go through. So, you know, the office place that has a computer system does mostly the same things as the pre-computer office, but the actual activities are completely reorganized by that technology. So given that, I think we can look to how these different kinds of robotic technologies would transform norms. So already we can see with these small aerial drones, there's certain assumptions that we have about privacy in public space. And it's built on assumptions that it's actually really expensive to do aerial surveillance. So most people don't do aerial surveillance. So we don't really need a lot of policy and regulation around that. But now it's becoming, you know, incredibly inexpensive to do aerial surveillance, and everybody's going to start doing it. So do we need, you know, policies or new norms about taking photographs in public to manage that? In the case of the autonomous weapon systems, we've always assumed that humans controlled weapons. There's a few, you know, outliers or special cases that have existed historically. But for the most part, using a violent force, using a weapon, it was a human who made that decision, even if it was a long-range bombing or artillery or something like that. Now we have a situation where we can design algorithms to make those decisions. And we have a set of laws that, you know, presume that a human makes the decisions. And it's not really the same thing when an algorithm makes a choice as when a human makes a choice. And so that substitution destabilizes the norm, and that has various effects. It affects how we deal with accountability for, you know, civilians who are accidentally killed, or potential war crimes, or technical mistakes in general. And we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with that. So we could just say, well, yeah, we can just treat algorithms as identical to humans and just leave it at that, even though we're going to have all these secondary problems, and we'll just try to deal with those. Or you can say, look, actually, we want to specify more particularly, like, which kinds of things humans have to make decisions about and which ones don't they. Is it necessary for a human's eyes to see this and process that information and approve it before they take action? And, you know, we've seen this also with, like, robo-signing of evictions from and for foreclosures in the housing market. There's been some states attorney generals who were prosecuting banks for, you know, allowing computers to approve foreclosures. It's you're supposed to have a human, right? Yes. Are we going to allow algorithms to do that? And these are things that, you know, have huge impacts on people's lives. And there's, I think, a sense of due process and due diligence that sort of needs to take place before you take away somebody's house or take away somebody's life. And other things, it's maybe not so necessary, right? We can automate a lot of things in society, and that's going to be okay. So I think, you know, it's figuring out which of those critical norms, and then thinking through, like, how do we actually want them to go? So there's a lot of debate around the self-driving cars, and they may find themselves in situations where an accident is unavoidable, and how do we want them to behave? Do they, you know, run down an adult or a child if those are their only choices? Things like that, where, you know, maybe there's not a right answer or a wrong answer, but as soon as we design technologies that are going to have to make those kinds of decisions, we have to have a public discussion about what we as a society want these technologies to do in those situations, because we're going to have to live in that society. So I think a lot of it is just getting the public involved in these discussions as well.
So, Peter, you've alluded to a question I want to ask you about, and something you've written about. Let me ask you two questions, really, with regard to the public here. And, you know, one before I get to some of your writing on the role of the public in coming up with these norms. You know, is it pie in the sky? Is it naive? Is it wrong to simply suggest that one way to deal with this problem is to somehow, and maybe that's the answer, is that it can't be done, somehow inculcate in society, and particularly in companies and researchers, the notion that there maybe needs to be a slowdown in the development of these technologies? In other words, the regular critique of law and lawmakers and policy is that it can't keep up or doesn't keep up with technology. And yet maybe the critique should be that innovation's happening too quickly and people need to slow down, or at least bottle up the research in a way that allows for it to be introduced in a thoughtful manner, rather than introduced primarily, as you and I have alluded to, both for military reasons and for reasons of efficiency and profit making. So I guess, you know, the question boils down to, am I basically just painting, you know, in a Mumford sense, a utopia that simply can never exist? Or is it something that should never exist? Or is it something we should think about? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, out of those options, I'll give the let's talk about it and think about it option. But yeah. I think, you know, I'm pro-technology, and I find it really frustrating when there's always this sort of opposition between, well, you know, if we want to regulate a technology, that means we're going to, like, kill it, the industry, or slow it down, or, you know, you're either, you know, all in on technology or you're a Luddite. And I'm trying to sort of carve out this middle space a little bit, and I don't think they're really all that opposed to each other. And if we think just about regulatory systems for cars and UAVs, that, you know, in order for these industries to flourish, they're going to need a good regulatory framework. So regulations enable technology in certain situations. And then I think, you know, if we also kind of take the step back from thinking about the technology just as the artifact or the piece of software, and think about it as how it's embedded in the society, and think of it as a socio-technical system, then what we really need to do is kind of optimize it and innovate at this kind of larger level. And if we do that, then, you know, and this is what I mean, I guess, by norms innovation, that instead of always innovating on the technology side, we also need to kind of innovate on the norm side. And rather than, you know, just saying we should slow down the technology to let the norms catch up, why don't we actually start thinking about how to accelerate and innovate around norms? And the fact that we only have a handful of lawyers and philosophers who are thinking about these questions is probably a sign that, you know, they're not going to figure out all of the answers as quickly as these armies of, you know, programmers and engineers who are developing these systems, who have massive financial backing and all kinds of, financial and profit and motives for the companies that are doing that research. So we've seen a little bit with Google's acquisition of DeepMind that they've introduced an internal ethics advisory board. It's not very transparent how it will operate and what kinds of technologies it's going to be thinking about or talking about, mostly in the artificial intelligence realm. But I think there's a lot of space for thinking about how do we get these kinds of forum for discussing these issues. How do we bring together, experts in these various areas of law and technology and the public and start thinking about and discussing, like, how are these going to impact the public? Not just, what does the public say they want in some, opinion poll or something, but to actually allow them to see how the technologies work and interact with prototypes and think through in a more design fashion, what are the options? If we're going to have healthcare robots taking care of the elderly, what should the model be? Are these going to be, big warehouses where we leave old people at a certain point in time, or are we going to make the effort to develop technologies that can assist people in their homes so they actually don't have to relocate to nursing homes? This is really a social question. We can develop technology either way, but we have to decide as a society, what is our ultimate goal and what do we want for, our old age?
Peter Asaro, a professor at the New School. We have a couple of minutes left. Like I said, and I appreciate you're actually attempting to make your answers a little shorter for the time we have left. And so kudos to you on complex stuff. You wrote in the piece to which I referred earlier that, again, is available on the We Robot website and is entitled Regulating Robots: Approaches to Developing Robot Policy and Technology. You write, as a matter of expertise, the public is not always well informed of complex issues such as international law and likely does not hold any antecedent opinion on arcane matters with complex legal implications. I think that critique, certainly applies in a number of areas, but robotics may be at the top of the list given how new the technology is and how complex the issues are. So what do you think is the role of rule and lawmaking bodies in the creation of these norms around robotics? Do we have institutions that can handle this? You've referred to expertise, but how is that played out? And you have about 1 minute to answer that question.
Well, I think one of the things I also read about in that paper is that it's actually in some ways encouraging that the United Nations has a forum like the CCW, which allows us as civil society, these non-governmental organizations, to go and speak to the diplomats and the policymakers who have the ability to create the policies and regulations. The FAA has public hearing. It's not clear that there's as much public transparency when it actually comes to the rulemaking that those bodies do. But there is a sort of mechanism for that. The problem with the FAA and the drones right now is they don't really want to touch the privacy issue. They just want to deal with the safety issues. So while they're hearing from the public that privacy is going to be an issue, I don't know that they're going to respond. But I think there's a pretty fundamental issue in making this connection between the public and the novices and the experts. And it's experts in a lot of different areas of policy and technology. And I think that's the big challenge. And we've got a couple examples of how it can be done, and I think we can really innovate around that. And, there's been all the stakeholder participation kind of discussions. Often, though, the way they carve out stakeholders is, the manufacturers and the regulators and the policymakers, and, the public is kind of outside of all of that. And I think we really need the public involved in it. In more ways.
So, Peter, in 20 seconds, for members of the public, like my listeners, who want to learn more about this burgeoning but very nascent area, other than the We Robot website, where do you recommend they look just if you want to keep up with what's going on in the field?
Well, there's You can go to my Twitter feed at Peter Acero, and I post a lot of news around robotics and artificial intelligence. You can go to the stopkillerrobots.org website to find out more about the campaign to stop killer robots. They also have a Twitter feed and a Facebook page, and the International Committee for Robot Arms Control at icrac.net. We'll tell you a lot more about that organization and our experts and our work on arms control there. There's actually just so much news happening around robotics. It's really hard to keep up with anymore, even for myself. But there's also a great website called RoboHub.org that will keep you abreast of the latest news in robotics. And there's also an Open Robot Ethics Initiative .org, which does a lot of kind of the robot ethics stuff.
Peter Acero, professor, School of Media Studies at the New School, and a fellow at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton, and a fellow affiliate scholar, I guess I could say that, at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I hope for both of us that in our respective old ages that you can come back on Hearsay Culture at its 40-year anniversary. And we can continue these discussions between now and then, because obviously there's going to be tremendous work to be done here. Thank you for your work in the space, and thank you for taking time to chat with my listeners today.
Well, thank you for having me, and if I'm back for the 40th anniversary, I'll bring my robot.
Sounds good. We have a number of guests coming up in the remaining schedule on Hearsay Culture. Coming up next week, Professor Arvind Narayanan of Princeton on algorithmic computing and Bitcoin. Jacob Silverman, author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of Constant Connection. Gabby Coleman, or Biella Coleman, professor at McGill University, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. And Margot Kaminsky of the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, who writes in a number of interesting areas, including robotics, as well as international trade, privacy, and surveillance. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, Wednesdays, on kzsulive.stanford.edu, or in the Bay Area at 90.1 FM. You can get the show by going to the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School's iTunes page, by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the newly redesigned hearsayculture.com website, where you can get all 230-plus previous episodes as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by going, now I can say this, to the website at hearsayculture.com and clicking on Contact, where you can actually contact me directly and send me any comments you'd like. Incidentally, you will have to indicate that you're not a robot by entering some text. Although I guess I should say I welcome robot comments, I guess. Peter may have an opinion on that, too. Or you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.